Welcome back, everybody, to another POWReport.com podcast for the week of December 17, 2017. Welcome back. Hope that you are doing well. We don't have any major events of the week really coming up, other than a weekly VA Veterans Center is open every week on Thursdays from 8 to 12. And this week, they have a special VA social worker who is coming into town, Robin. So if you need any help with anything, definitely stop by this Thursday from 8 to 12. And if you have any events that you would like to advertise, please email me at powreport@gmail.com. Without further ado, let's just jump right into the trooper report. We have location Kasan. The type is warrant arrest, and the dispatch text reads that on December 13th, at approximately 1650 hours, Alaska State Troopers on POW and Kasan were at a residence in Kasan after receiving information that a certain Robert Young Jr., age 49, of Kasan, was at the residence. Young had multiple warrants issued for his arrest for charges of burglary in the first degree, assault in the fourth degree, and a PTRP. Young was located at the residence and was arrested on the warrants. Young was remanded to the Craig City facility jail with a combined bail of $15,000. We have location Heidelberg. The dispatch text reads that on December 15th, at approximately 1:15 p.m., the Alaska State Troopers on POW conducted a traffic stop on a vehicle and identified the driver as 36-year-old Heidelberg resident Anthony Peel. Peel was out of compliance with the sex offender registry and was arrested. Peel was transported to the Craig Police Department, where he was remanded and then further released. Of course, there is one final public safety advisory from the Department of the State Troopers. They just want to point out that this is in fact the holiday seasons, and the Alaska State Troopers are going to be extra vigilant through the first couple of days of January. So please, if you drink, please don't drive, get a cab, we have friends. Don't get pulled over, don't do anything illegal, and enjoy your holidays. So there you have it. A quick rundown of the Trooper Report and the events, and now we're just going to share a quick story of the week. It's raining, the heavens have opened, it's a torrential downpour, great sheets of rain are pouring down, it's raining sideways. All those descriptions of precipitation make a certain amount of sense. But what about when we look outside the window to see a major storm and say, wow, it's raining cats and dogs? Evocative, yes, but as a metaphor, it's pretty lame. It's one of those things people say without ever thinking about it. Not even heavy raindrops look anything like furry mid-sized animals, so where did the expression come from anyway? No one is quite sure, though there are several mythological explanations and a few historical citations. One popular mythological explanation involves Odin, the fierce Norse god of wisdom, battle, healing, frenzy, and tempests, who was often pictured with animals, particularly dogs and wolves. So when the Norse god was throwing down rain, he was throwing down the dogs. But, of course, that doesn't account for the cats. So maybe cats and dogs comes from the Greek expression katadoxa, which conveniently sounds like cats and dogs, but means contrary to experience or belief. So when you can't believe how hard it's raining a katsadoxa. A commonly repeated, if slightly unbelievable, folktale has it that in the olden times, domestic animals would make nests in thatched roofs. A heavy downpour would wash the animals out of the thatch, causing them to tumble down to the ground. So it appeared to be literally raining cats and dogs. Upon closer inspection, this theory, of course, doesn't hold up well. Cats might conceivably leap up into a roof to make a home, but dogs aren't generally that nimble. In literature, a seemingly similar phrase turns up as early as 1651. In a collection of poems called Olor Escanenas, the Welsh poet Henry Vaughan writes, "Themselves with a roof that can secure the sales from dogs and cats rent and shower." The phrase must have been very popular currency at the time, because in 1653 the English playwright Richard Brome penned a line in City Wit, "It shall rain dogs and polecats." Today, in the American South, which inherited many of its idioms from the UK, polecat is synonymous with skunk. Of course, in the next century, the phrase was indisputably appropriated by Jonathan Swift, who was a prolific writer and master of deadpan satire, who delighted in undermining authority, and in 1710, in a poem called A Description of a City Shower, his evocative language is calculated for exaggerated gross-out effect. Quote, "Sweeping from butcher stalls, dung, guts, and blood, drowned puppies, stinking sprats, all drenched in mud, dead cats and turnips tops come tumbling down the flood." And indeed, this poem harkens back to the idea of drowned animals floating in city streets. The phrase also appears in modern form in Swift's 1738 book, A Complete Collection of Polite Indigenous Conversation, in which, of course, he satirizes a conversation of the upper classes. "I know Sir John will go, though he was sure it would rain cats and dogs." Other countries have even more bizarre idioms. According to Mental Floss, in South Africa, they say, "It's raining old women with clubs." In Argentina, "It's raining dunghead first." And in Slovakia, "Tractors are falling," and in Ireland, "It's throwing cobble knives." So there you have it, the quick story of the week. And finally, to round off this podcast, we're going to read another evocative chapter from Ego is the Enemy. Thanks.
Dead and be damned, and the rest gone whist.
Yo ho ho, and a bottle of rum.
The skipper lay with his knob in gore, where the scullion's axe in his cheek had shore, and the scullion he was stabbed four times more. And there they lay, and the soggy skies dripped all day long in upstaring eyes. At murk sunset and at foul sunrise.
The legend of Genghis Khan has echoed through history. A barbarian conqueror fueled by bloodlust terrorized the civilized world. We have him and his Mongol horde traveling across Asia and Europe, insatiable, stopping at nothing to plunder, rape, and kill not just the people who stood in their way, but the cultures they had built. Then, not unlike his nomadic band of warriors, this terrible cloud simply disappeared from history, because the Mongols built nothing that could last. Like all reactionary, emotional assignments, this could not be more wrong. For not only was Genghis Khan one of the greatest military minds who had ever lived, he was a perpetual student whose stunning victories were often the result of his ability to absorb the best technologies, practices, and innovations of each new culture his empire touched. In fact, if there is one theme in his reign, and in the several centuries of dynastic rules that followed, it is this: appropriation. Under Genghis Khan's direction, the Mongols were as ruthless about stealing and absorbing the best of each culture they encountered as they were about conquering itself. Though there were essentially no technological inventions, no beautiful buildings or even great Mongol art, with each battle and enemy, their culture learned and absorbed something new. Genghis Khan was not born a genius. Instead, as one biographer put it, his was a, quote, "persistent cycle of pragmatic learning." experimental adaptation, and constant revision driven by his uniquely disciplined and focused will. He was the greatest conqueror the world had ever known, because he was more open to learning than any other conqueror had ever been. Khan's first powerful victories came from the reorganization of his military units, splintering his soldiers into groups of 10. This he stole from the neighboring Turkic tribes and unknowingly converted the Mongols to the decimal system. Soon enough, their expanding empire brought them into contact with another technology they'd never experienced before, walled cities. In the Tangut raids, Khan first learned the ins and outs of war against fortified cities and the strategies critical to laying siege, and quickly became an expert. Later, with the help from Chinese engineers, he taught his soldiers how to build siege machines that could knock down city walls. In his campaigns against the Jurshid, Khan learned the importance of winning hearts and minds by working with the scholars and royal family of the lands he conquered. Khan was able to hold on to and manage these territories in ways that most empires could not. Afterwards, in every country or city he held, Khan would call for the smartest astrologers, scribes, doctors, thinkers, and advisors. In fact, anyone who could aid his troops and their efforts. His troops traveled with interrogators and translators for precisely this purpose. It was a habit that would survive his death. While the Mongols themselves seemed dedicated almost solely to the art of war, they put to good use every craftsman, merchant, scholar, entertainer, cook, and skilled worker they came in contact with. The Mongol Empire was remarkable for its religious freedoms, and most of all, for its love of ideas and convergence of cultures. It brought lemons to China for the first time, and Chinese noodles to the West. It spread Persian carpets, German mining technology, French metalworking, and, grossly enough, Islam. The cannon, which revolutionized warfare, was said to be the resulting fusion of Chinese gunpowder, Muslim flamethrowers, and European metalwork. It was Mongol openness to learning and new ideas that brought them all together. As we first succeed, we will find ourselves in new situations facing new problems. The freshly promoted soldier must learn the art of politics, the salesman how to manage, the founder how to delegate, the writer how to edit others, the comedian on how to act, and the chef turned restaurateur how to run the other side of the house. This is not a harmless conceit. The physicist John Wheeler, who helped develop the hydrogen bomb, once observed that as our island of knowledge grows, so does the shore of our ignorance. In other words, each victory and advancement that made Khan smarter also bumped him against new situations he'd never encountered before. It takes a special kind of humility to grasp that you know less, and even as you know and grasp more and more. With accomplishments comes a growing pressure to pretend that we know more than we do, to pretend we already know everything. Scientia infla, knowledge puffs up. That's the worry and the risk, thinking that we're set and secure when in reality, understanding and mastery is a fluid, continual process. The 9-time Grammy and Pulitzer winner, jazz musician Wynton Marsalis, once advised a promising young musician on the mindset required in a lifelong study of music. Quote, humility engenders learning because it beats back the arrogance that puts blinders on. It leaves you open for truths to reveal themselves. You don't understand in your own way. Do you know how you can tell when someone is truly humble? I believe that there is one simple test, because they consistently observe and listen. The humble improve. They don't assume I know the way. No matter what you've done up to this point, you better still be a student. If you're not still learning, you're already dying. It is not enough only to be a student at the beginning. It is a position that one has to assume for life. Learn from everyone and everything. From the people you beat and the people who beat you, from the people you dislike, and even from your supposed enemies. At every step and every juncture in life, there is the opportunity to learn, and even in the lesson, is purely remedial. We must not let ego block us from hearing it again. Too often convinced of our own intelligence, we stay in a comfort zone that ensures that we never feel stupid and are never challenged to learn or reconsider what we in fact know. It obscures from view various weaknesses in our understanding until eventually it's too late to change course. This is where the silent toll is taken. Each of us faces a threat as we pursue our craft. Like sirens on the rocks, ego sings a soothing, validating song, which can lead to a wreck. The second we let the ego tell us that we have graduated, learning grinds to a halt. And that's why Frank Shamrock said, always stay a student, as in, it never ends. The solution is as straightforward as it is initially uncomfortable. Pick up a book on a topic you know next to nothing about. Put yourself in rooms where you're the least knowledgeable person. That uncomfortable feeling, that defensiveness that you feel when your most deeply held assumptions are challenged, what about subjecting yourself to it deliberately? Change your mind and change your surroundings. An amateur is defensive. So are social justice warriors and snowflake millennials. The professional finds learning and even occasionally being shown up to be enjoyable, and they like being challenged and humbled and engaged in education as an ongoing and endless process. Most military cultures and people in general seek to impose values and control over what they encounter. What made the Mongols different was their ability to weigh each situation objectively and, if need be, swap out previous practices for new ones. All great businesses, of course, start this way, but then something happens along the way. Take the theory of disruption, which posits at some point in time every industry will be disrupted by some trend or innovation that, despite all the resources in the world, the incumbent interests will be incapable of responding to. Now, why is this? Why can't businesses change and adapt? A large part of it is because they lost the ability to learn, and they stopped being students. The second this happens to you, your knowledge becomes fragile. The great manager and business thinker Peter Drucker says that it's not enough simply to want to learn. As people progress, they must also understand how they learn, and then set up processes to facilitate this continual education. Otherwise, we are dooming ourselves to a sort of self-imposed ignorance.
Leave them over and out of sight with a yo-hee-ho.